Proceed to the second case of the day, Blanco v. Prudential Insurance.
May it please the court. Thank you. It's my first time to work with these amplifiers, so bear with me. If I suddenly fiddle and go back to my hearing aids, it's one of the joys of starting out hard of hearing and then growing older as well. The central issue in this appeal is whether Prudential has shown that a rather narrow pre-existing condition exclusion applied to the disability at issue. Norman Blanco, now deceased, was an engineer at Porsche. He became disabled in July of 2005 as a result of a myocardial infarction, a heart attack. The policy contains a pre-existing condition clause exclusion that requires that Prudential show two things to exclude coverage. One is it must show that during the three-month look-back period, which ran from February of 2005 to early May of 2005, he must have received treatment for the same condition that disabled him. Or, in the alternative, this is Section 1B, he must have had symptoms for which a reasonably prudent person would have sought medical treatment implicitly but did not during that same look-back period. The problem with the district court's opinion below are both substantive and procedural, but I'll deal with the substantive ones first, and that is this. They can't satisfy either one of those conditions. In fact, you'll see in the correspondence that they wrote letters claiming to have satisfied both. In fact, one letter writes that on 102, claims that he received treatment during the look-back period. But the letter sent the same day, and Mr. Blanco says he didn't receive treatment. That's at 104. So they put out contradictory letters on the same day. Then by December, on the first appeal, they said both conditions apply and both were satisfied. Well, in fact, neither were. 1A wasn't satisfied. That is, the treatment condition wasn't satisfied because there isn't any treatment received for a myocardial infarction or heart attack during the three-month look-back period. The disabling condition was a heart attack. That's the primary diagnosis.
Well, he was taking cardiac medicine through that whole period, wasn't he?
Pardon me? No, he was not.
He was taking cardiac medicine.
He was taking medications prescribed for hypertension. If you look at the medications...
That's closely associated with heart disease.
But this court has held, and other courts have held, that it's not enough to show a look back, to look back and say there's an association between...
Well, I mean, he had a heart attack back in 99.
He did, outside
he
of the pre...
He had
the
stents in 2002.
Correct. He had,
and,
there's no question.
He ran a blood pressure of 210 or 20 or something like that.
He had high blood pressure, but, Your Honor...
If I were his doctor, I'd be a little bit concerned about a heart attack.
If you look at the records, look at actually the records, and that's one reason why it was so important for the district court to have admitted the testimony and affidavits of the doctors, the actual treating physicians below. If you look at the records, the heart normal box is checked for the 2015 visit, the February 15th, which is the only visit during the look-back period. That visit was for testicular pain, and then they discovered high blood pressure during the routine examination.
It was not only high, it was extraordinarily high.
And they recommended treatment for that. They discussed what to do.
They recommended hospitalization.
Initially. But if you look at the affidavit, again, it was excluded. The doctors discussed it with him and believed that medication, taking his medication, which Mr. Blanco said he had not taken FA, was an acceptable way of proceeding. But they knew his heart history. They checked him out for the heart problems.
Taking your medicine is going to shoot your blood pressure up to 210 or 220?
But the medication was for high. If you look at the indications for that medication and other medications, it's for blood pressure. And he checked heart normal. Not only that, they did an examination. And Prudential never talked to the treating physicians, never talked to Dr. Bobsey. In fact, they misidentified him as Dr. Black in the report. Dr. Bobsey, on his record, that record, which is at App 137, says... No denial, SOB, sorry, but that means shortness of breath, medical lingo. No chest pain, no heart angina arrhythmia. They checked him out for heart conditions. And it's not enough that he had hypertension. The disability is not for hypertension.
Well, medication for angina does not relate to hypertension.
Mr. Blanco in his affidavit, also excluded by the district court, testified he did not have chest pain. Angina is for chest pain. And the angina medication he was taking was for chest pain. And that medication was prescribed before the look-back period. And there's no evidence he was taking it during the look-back period. It's prescribed for the occasional response to chest pain, which he denied having. He denied having that. And there's no evidence he did have that condition during that period. So when you look at and it's a rather narrow exclusion. I mean, it doesn't include, unlike say in the thought case where there was language in the policy that would have included causally related physical phenomena such as high blood pressure. This policy doesn't contain that kind of language. It doesn't contain the language like in the thought case that would exclude a condition caused by, contributed to, or resulting from the pre-existing condition. It's a rather narrow exclusion. We cover people, after all, who have pre-existing conditions all the time. I mean, that is in the McLeod case, in the Pitcher case, in cases they have to fit within the specific terms of the exclusion itself. An exclusion to coverage, as an exclusion that defeats the purpose of the policy. The policy is to cover disabled people. Unless they can show that they fit precisely in that language, it's unjustified to find for their application of exclusion. The medications that he took, to turn to that, most of when you look at the description, and you'll see the description in a briefing and in the reports, it sort of takes things that were diagnosed or identified after the heart attack in 2005, after the look-back period, and relates them back. But if you look at all three of those medications, in the 12304 note, that's the note immediately before the look-back period, also found on Appendix 137, that says he's taking three blood pressure medications. Both physicians testified that those are what they discussed. They did not discuss with him any heart difficulties because he wasn't experiencing any. They discussed his high blood pressure and what to do about it. High blood pressure, after all, can be a disabling condition, but it wasn't a disabling condition here. And the fact that it looks consistent with a later heart attack does not qualify it under the pre-existing condition clause.
You had a previous heart attack, though.
He did have a previous
heart attack. Blood pressure of that magnitude is a pretty bad symptom.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that's the other clause, and let's turn to that second clause, which is the symptom clause. Did he have symptoms? And symptoms not defined in the policy, but a symptom in a dictionary says subjective evidence of disease or physical disturbance. Now, he had a symptom of high blood pressure, a symptom, but that's actually, it's not even a symptom in that definition, since it's not subjective evidence. It's evidence discovered by a medical examination. It's not a subjective evidence, but it is not a symptom of a heart attack or of congestive heart failure or cardiomyopathy. In the Wright case, in contrast, you had hypertension, which then the disabling condition that came from that was malignant hypertension, and the court in that case connected those two. But that's not a connection that is necessarily made here. It's not a symptom of the actual disabling condition. In fact, the disabling condition doesn't occur until after. I mean, the disabling condition is a heart attack. That kills part of his heart. The evidence of a precursor to that or a risk factor in advance of that, whether it be high blood pressure or smoking or obesity or a sedentary lifestyle or even the male gender, those things are not symptoms of the disabling condition, unless the disabling condition later turned out to be hypertension, which it didn't. If you look at the language that Prudential adopts and its nurses adopt in describing this, you'll see that they come mostly, the only mention of hypertensive heart disease is in the post-heart attack medical history that's taken. Nothing before. Nothing in the pre-existing condition period, nothing before that.
Now, nitroglycerin, does that do anything for your blood pressure?
No, that is a medication for chest pain, angina. He came
that's
to see.
What I thought, but you're claiming that all these medications were for high blood pressure.
No, I mean, precisely, his medication, that was prescribed in December of 2004, before the look-back period, not during the look-back period. And there's no evidence
he was taking it during the period.
No, there's actually no evidence he was taking it during the look-back period, Your Honor. That's one, but if it is, it is evidence, it is not medication treatment for the heart attack that is yet to occur. And that is a disabling condition. And that's a problem here. The court below took an exclusion which should be construed narrowly and precisely and expanded it to be construed broadly and thus eliminating coverage and defeating the purpose of the policy. Now, the second, and that brings me to the procedural error that the court committed, and that was not admitting the affidavits of the three treating physicians as well as Mr. Blanco himself. Now, it was allowed to do so under the patent case, could do that. It also actually, so one side, one other procedural error I wanted to mention was that it did not conduct a kind of de novo review as required under the Diaz case at all. If you look at page 22, you'll see that what it really did was reviewing Prudential's conduct or assessment of the matter. It said at page 22, says Prudential correctly determined. That's not what it's supposed to be doing. It's supposed to be conducting de novo review. Prudential has to prove not that it acted correctly, but that the precondition exclusion actually applies. Now, patent allows a court to admit evidence that doesn't come in with the administrative record to make an informed and independent judgment. And I submit, as we've said in our brief, that this is sort of a collection of factors here, no one of which might be dispositive, but certainly collectively they argued that the court should have looked at those affidavits. Those include that there was no independent doctor review here at all. There was no doctor review at all by Prudential. No physician has agreed. No physician anywhere has agreed with their assessment of a pre-existing condition. It's all nurses and lawyers making those assertions for Prudential. Prudential never spoke to the doctors. It never interviewed the treating physicians. Now, and the district court inferred that they did, or drew an inference that they did, or actually construed it incorrectly. If you look at page 89 and 90, you'll see that Prudential only called the doctor's offices when the doctor's offices were closed. It made four calls. The one call they got records, the first call they learned the offices were closed on Wednesdays, and if you look at Appendix 8990, you'll find that they made two calls after that, both on a Wednesday. That's not a good faith effort to try and talk to the treating physicians. Mr. Blanco was disabled. He had a right to a second appeal. When we were engaged, Mr. Blanco, now deceased, engaged us after his first appeal is already over. The second appeal is optional. Under the express terms of the plan, page at Appendix 67, Prudential agrees to waive any objection to failure to exhaust administrative remedies. Yet that is exactly what they're doing and did in their motion to strike and exactly what the court accepted. They waived that as part of the plan, any objection to failure to exhaust administrative remedies. So those affidavits should have been admitted for that reason as well. In addition, there's an inherent conflict of interest here, such as this court has identified in the Hitsu case where where the insurance company is acting as both the administrator and as a payer under the plan, and that's what we had here. And that court held, and it's been followed since then, that the court should look searchingly at that when that circumstance and look and consider evidence in a specially certain way. There's a narrow exclusion. There's evident confusion by Prudential itself in putting out three different descriptions, three different ways of analyzing your own pre-existing condition exclusion. And by the way, there's no doubt that in their own letters, and those letters I identified for you at Appendix 96 to 95, 96, and 102 to 105, those letters say it has to be the same condition. They interpret that clause to include not something that can be pre-existing in the sense of a different, possibly causally related or symptomatic phenomenon, but it has to be the exact same condition. That's what they say in their letters, and that's how it ought to be interpreted. The evaluation, finally, also involves diagnostic capacity. It has to be, a physician has to, it's a medical evaluation of whether that condition exists, and that did not occur here. And, in fact, the nurses Prudential engaged are not qualified to do so. And I see my time is up. I will reserve the remainder. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bluth. Ms. Bailey.
Good morning, Your Honors. Edna Bailey for the defendants at police. May it please the court, opposing counsel. Mr. Blanco's compromised state of health, which led to his claim for disability in this case in October.
That just records, it doesn't amplify, so if you could keep your voice up.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Mr. Blanco's compromised state of health, which led to his claim for disability benefits in October of 2005, was not an overnight development.
Just so I understand this policy, if he had the heart attack in May of 06 instead of when he did, then he would have, and all other things being equal, he would have been entitled to long-term disability benefits from that time on. Is that correct?
If his claim incurred outside of the 12 months, yes, that is correct,
I mean,
Your Honor.
He only worked here 10 weeks or something.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And then, but if he had just made it over the finish line.
Had he made it over the finish line? he would have been able to be insured. He would have been eligible for long-term disability benefits.
Okay.
Yes. It is not in dispute, however, that in this case, Mr. Blanco left his employment on July 26th.
Yes, I understand.
Which was...
Well, what's your strongest argument, that he should have had treatment or that a reasonable person should have sought treatment?
I think
which is the stronger of the two?
I think they're equally strong, but I favor...
Most lawyers would always say that. But if you had to pick one or the other...
I would pick the first one. I would say that the treatment for hypertensive crisis, that his taking of medications, especially lisinopril, which he admitted to have taken since 1999 as a result of his prior heart attack, lisinopril guarantees survival, or at least aids in survival after a prior heart attack. It treats congestive heart failure, which Mr. Blanco's medical records identify to have been present for the remainder of 6 years prior to his coverage began. Those medications being taken during the look-back period, as well as his presenting to Dr. Bobzien with a high blood pressure or an extraordinarily high blood pressure of 210 over 132 on February 15th of 2005, clearly indicates to me that this man was a very sick man with a very serious heart condition, which has a long-standing history. This was not an overnight development. He didn't...
Is in your position that with that kind of a heart pressure, any reasonable patient would have gone into the hospital, or is he excused because his doctor apparently didn't force him to do so?
I think he should have gone to the hospital. He had a prior heart attack. He had congestive heart failure. He was recommended to be under constant medical management just shortly before the pre-existing condition. And he did not stop drinking or stop smoking. He continued his lifestyle. He did not make any changes. And presented with a blood pressure of 210 over 132, obviously I'm not a doctor, but 210 over 32 seems to me almost twice as much as what any ordinary person should healthily have. As a result of that, when his doctor mentioned hospitalization, he should have submitted himself to the hospital. Equally telling, I think, in this case, is Mr. Blanco's admission to Prudential as early as shortly after his claim submission that he stopped going to doctors because every time he did, they sent him to the hospital. I understand that nobody likes to go to the hospital. Nonetheless, however, this is an indication that Mr. Blanco's condition was serious, that it was not controlled, that it was uncontrolled as a matter of fact, and that he should have sought constant and persistent and reasonable medical care. This is something Mr. Blanco did not do. The way of how Mr. Blanco in this case has argued...
Did the doctor tell him that going home was just as good as going to the hospital, or did he... Did he withdraw his recommendation and go to the hospital?
Sorry.
No, when he had this very high blood pressure, did the physician withdraw? He told him to go to the hospital. Did he withdraw that recommendation and say, if you go home, that's just as good? Or did he continue to recommend he go to the hospital?
He seemed to have conceded to Mr. Blanco's will to just go home and take his medical, his medicine, but Dr. Bobzien is not a cardiologist. So one could argue that maybe he did not understand the severity of this condition. Our skilled disability reviewers were of the opinion that in light of the severity of Mr. Blanco's condition, he should have presented to the hospital. And that seems to also be supported by Mr. Blanco's previous cardiologist, Dr. Moon, who he saw in November and December of 2004, recommending persistent medical management. My guess would be that any cardiologist would have sent Mr. Blanco to the hospital with a blood pressure of 210 over 132. Another factor I would like to stress in this case is that the policy does not require that the disabling condition is a diagnosis. It does not require that there is treatment for a certain diagnosis during the look-back period, and that as a result of that diagnosis, the disability claim is submitted. Disability under the policy is defined as the inability to perform the material and substantial duties of one's regular occupation due to sickness or injury. It does not require that one has a specific diagnosis. Health cannot be compartmentalized, and this is what I believe Mr. Blanco is doing in this case. Mr. Blanco has a heart condition. This heart condition has several conditions within itself, and Mr. Blanco's heart condition escalated over a span of roughly 6 years, from 1999 when his heart attack occurred to further escalation until he eventually submitted his claim for disability. The last facet, the last aggravation or escalation triggered the claim of disability in this case, but the underlying condition, the real disability, is caused by Mr. Blanco's compromised heart. And hypertension, especially a hypertensive crisis, which could also be summed up as hypertensive heart disease, is a part of that heart condition. There is no question that lisinopril was prescribed as a result of Mr. Blanco's heart, his prior heart attack, and his risk of congestive heart failure. This is not a case where somebody has simply high blood pressure, where somebody has high blood pressure over an extended period of time and suddenly, once he started new employment, experienced a heart attack. This is not what happened in this case. Mr. Blanco had a very serious heart condition, and it cannot be compartmentalized into one specific aspect. The whole disabling scenario needs to be reviewed. This is a situation that involves several facets of a sick heart. And I believe the policy supports this. The policy does not require that a condition causes the disability. What the policy indeed does is it defines pre-existing condition as any condition whatsoever for which is treatment received or for which a prudent person should be receiving treatment. It does not mention within the definition of pre-existing condition what that condition is that treatment needs to be received. The exclusion portion is actually above it, and the exclusion portion indicates that a claimant may not recover for any disability which is due to a pre-existing condition. That's where the causation comes in. There's a causal element here, cause and effect, between a pre-existing condition and a subsequent disability, which is made claim for. In this case, that's exactly what happened. Mr. Blanco received treatment. In addition to that, given the scenario, given the medical records and the opinions that were submitted, he should have received treatment. A prudent person would have not treated his health this way. A prudent person would have made changes. A prudent person would have submitted himself to the hospital when presenting with blood pressure of 210 over 132. A prudent person would have also continued to take the prescribed medication. There's no question. It almost seems, which is something that the district court articulated in its opinion, that Mr. Blanco purposefully did not treat during the pre-existing condition. He stressed to Prudential on multiple occasions that he did not see a doctor for his heart condition. He did not account for his condition. He did not go and see a doctor, and during the look-back period laid low, so to say, and avoided treatment until thereafter he submitted his claim as a result of possibly his neglect of his health condition. Such a thing should not be allowed. It is something that the pre-existing condition attempts to prevent and protect insurers for. That's exactly what the pre-existing condition exclusion attempts to accomplish. The second issue that Mr. Blanco has raised in this appeal is a procedural issue, the question as to whether the affidavits submitted by his treating physicians were properly stricken from the record by the district court. We submit that they were. The district court had the discretion under Patton versus Sun Life to do so. It evaluated the affidavits in depth. There are indeed several paragraphs which outline exactly what content these affidavits would have provided to the case. And as a result of that, after the evaluation and after review of the medical records in this case, the district court decided that it did not need the additional information, which is something it is allowed to do in its discretion. The medical records in this case, as we submit as well, are clear. And as a result of that, the additional information submitted by plaintiff's treating physicians are not necessary to decide this case. In addition to that, the information, even if...
Would it be useful, though, to know more about what this interview with his physician in February, what the exact circumstances of that were? Where do we get that information from? Is that based on just the notes that were made at that time?
Yeah. Based on the medical notes as they are written down, plaintiff presented for testicular pain.
Of course, that's a contemporary notation.
It is.
Whereas the affidavits were written long afterwards.
It was created in hindsight as an argumentative piece to support a lawsuit solicited by Mr. Blanco's attorneys. I would always go with the contemporary evidence. And the district court decided to do so as well. In addition to that, the district court evaluated the content of the affidavits and found that they were insufficient to raise a question of fact. As a result of that, as the district court correctly found that Prudential met its burden of proof and the affidavits, whether admitted or not admitted, do not raise a question of fact, they don't really change the outcome of this case. And summary judgment was properly granted to my client. As a final matter, Mr. Blanco's counsel in his argument accused Prudential of improperly reviewing the claim, mentioned a conflict of interest, but at the same time also accused the court of not conducting a de novo review and indicating that Prudential is correct. Counsel needs to decide what he wants. This case is governed by a de novo review, which means the court is to make an independent decision as to whether Prudential's decision was correct, as to whether Prudential met its burden of proof. The review before Prudential is, as this court noted in Diaz, irrelevant. The steps undertaken in the review and whether a full and fair review were granted, as this court has noted, is irrelevant. Whether Prudential called physicians, attempted to call them, and was not able to reach anybody under Diaz v. Prudential is irrelevant. All of these issues do not come into play. The same applies to the conflict of interest. The conflict of interest was recently discussed by the Supreme Court in Glenn versus MetLife. That matter is a matter governed by an arbitrary and capricious standard of review, and the Supreme Court held that the conflict of interest is to be a factor to be considered when conducting such an arbitrary and capricious standard of review. Conflict of interest doesn't matter when there's a de novo review such as here. This court, during oral argument, discussed this premise in Krolnick versus Prudential, where Mr. Krolnick raised the very same argument. A conflict of interest only matters when there's deference given to the insurer, when the insurer's decision is reviewed. We submit in this case that the evidence is to be reviewed independently, was reviewed independently by the district court, and supports my client's case. As a final matter, just real briefly, we believe that in any event, should the pre-existing condition exclusion not have been properly applied by my client, then a remand to Prudential would be the appropriate remedy. Prudential has not made a factual determination as to benefit eligibility. There are no records in this case that would support any type of level of functionality. We know that Mr. Blanco went through cardiac rehabilitation. We don't know how his functionality was thereafter. We don't know how his functionality was impacted overall, which is the question. Disability is not caused by a diagnosis. It's caused by a lack of function as a result of a condition. In order to make that determination, Prudential would have to review records. Prudential would have to make that decision first. And we would propose and request that a proper remedy in such a case would be a remand to my client. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey. Mr. Plews?
Thank you, Your Honor. The MetLife, first of all, about admission to the affidavits, MetLife doesn't make a conflict of interest irrelevant. It says it needs to be assessed in each case on a case-by-case basis. And what I cited to you for, what I cited the patent and why these affidavits are needed, is in this case, that conflict of interest is one of a number of factors saying the court should have looked at that evidence. And, Your Honor, to respond to your point, I urge the Court to look at the record, App 137, what it actually shows. It shows consideration by that doctor of whether or not there were harsh symptoms that needed to be acted on. No shortness of breath, as I said before, no chest pain, no heart angina, arrhythmia. And I think it is not the function of a pre-existing condition clause to second guess the lifestyle of the claimant. The clause either satisfied or it's not. And what Mr. Blanco's lifestyle was, or whether or not it's not a purpose of that clause to ensure a healthy lifestyle. The clause says you had symptoms for which an ordinary prudent person would have consulted a health care provider. Implicitly, more than implicitly, on its face, it obviously means you didn't consult a health care provider. Mr. Blanco did. The fact that they don't approve, that Prudential's lawyers or nurses don't approve of it, or even a judge doesn't approve of what he did and that he talked to his doctor and his doctor consulted and said, this is the treatment that will be acceptable. Take your blood pressure medication. By the way, there's absolutely no – the blood pressure, that Lipsinol medication is for blood pressure. That's its indication and its description in the contemporaneous medical records. And talking to those doctors, yes, it should have been. Prudential should have talked to those doctors at the time that it was investigating a claim to begin with instead of not leaving messages, not writing to him, not emailing him, not contacting him in any way at all to get an actual picture. They would have said we're looking for satisfaction of an exclusion to try to avoid coverage for this gentleman. They had such a problem. That's why the district court has such a problem deciding which is it. Is it treatment or not treatment? And in order to – that's the best badge I can point you to here of what it wasn't a situation in which the clause really fits and should be applied to exclude the coverage. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks, Bruce. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the third.